kboo.org. The application deadline is 5 p.m. on Wednesday, April 30th, 2014.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 10:59. Coming up at 11, Stage and Studio is off today. Instead, Bruce Silverman interviews Bill Carter about his book, Boom Bust Boom, an expose of copper mining. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Joseph Gallivan interviews Scott Fife, scenic designer for Portland Center Stage's current production of Othello, and Fred Shaning, the technical director at Portland Center Stage. They talk about the challenges and process of designing and building theater sets. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Artemis Foods, Portland's local organic and sustainable catering company since 2001. Special events, corporate and wedding catering with seasonal menus, and service supported by sustainable business operations. Artemis offers full service and drop-off catering. Information at artemisfoods.com.
Hello, this is Bruce Silverman. Today, my guest is Bill Carter, author of a book called Boom, Bust, Boom, published in 2012 by Scribner in hardcover and published in 2014 in paperback by Schaffner. Bill, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks, it's great being here.
This book is about copper mining and about how it affects Bill and his family and might affect you too. Let's start positive. What's good about copper? What's it used for?
Yeah, it's copper is an amazing metal with a history that really runs through about 10,000 years of our civilization. That's how long we've been mining it. In the beginning, it was used for simple things like makeup or to make utensils or combs. Eventually, it became very important to, let's say, the Romans especially, who made weapons out of it. And they created a copper empire, which was based in Cyprus, which means copper in Latin. In terms of modern civilization, the most important property is that it's a good conductor of heat for electricity. And it's also malleable, so plumbers can use it to bend around corners and stuff like that. So it has a wide range of uses. And today, cars, airplanes, computers, phones, this entire studio is wired with copper.
In fact, use is growing even in just recent years, right?
The production rate in the world has gone way up, and it's going to continue to grow probably for the next 25 years.
Well, this book, Boom, Bust, Boom, it's a memoir about the mining of copper. It's not an objective report. Now, Bill, you haven't been a miner, but copper mining has affected your life. You moved some years ago to Bisbee, Arizona, which was a former mining town. Why did you move there?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I lived in Tucson for about 4 or 5 years.
That's near Bisbee.
Yeah, it's in southern Arizona. I just happened to be taking weekend trips to Bisbee in my motorcycle, and it's gorgeous. You know, Tucson's kind of in the desert, but then you go south, but you go up in elevation. You go from about 3,000 feet to about 5,500 feet in the mountains. It's a hidden little hamlet. And Bisbee, in its heyday, was an enormous town. It was the biggest town between St. Louis and San Francisco and one of the biggest copper mines in the world. And when it closed in 75, the mine. And 75 is an interesting time in this country's history. It's, you know, the Vietnam War was done. There's a lot of turmoil. So that counterculture found Bisbee, and the miners were leaving and selling homes for $500. So people went down there and created a very esoteric, eclectic, artistic town that really spoke to me, and very interesting homes. And so anyways, I found a real kinship with the town.
Okay, and the mine was closed, but eventually it affected you.
There used to be smelters in Bisbee, right in the town. And smelters, which the United States has gotten rid of almost all of the smelters. There's about two left, large-scale smelters. One of them's in Arizona, in Hayden. Smelters are a guaranteed way to poison the surrounding community. They just belch out the heavy metals. So what happened is the smelter belched out arsenic, lead, whatever else. It just sat in the soil. Those metals don't go away. They don't go away after 100 years of rain and erosion. They just hang out. The second part was that Bisbee is built on these canyons, and when they wanted to create homesteads, they had to kind of dig out a hole in the mountain, but then they needed to level it. And so back then, they didn't really think about things like tailings piles being toxic waste or toxic, you know, heavy with metals. And so they just took it from the tailings pile, the dirt, and then made level foundations. So you have kind of two things happening. You have, you know, taking the actual tailings, which today would be never allowed, and you had the smelter, which laid down the metals. And now they've basically replaced all the dirt, almost all the homes in all of Bisbee.
When you moved there, that hadn't been done in your yard. Your yard was basically made from tailings.
Mm-hmm.
And you grew some lettuce, and you ate the lettuce, and you got sick.
I did. I got very sick.
Well, could copper be mined more cleanly and more safely? Is it possible? It seems to be a necessity for our civilization to have copper.
Right.
So could it be done better, or is society just going to have to face the fact that sometimes people are going to get sick from this necessity?
It's a good question, and it's a hard one to answer. The honest answer is the scale at which copper mining is done today, which is enormous open pits, it's very difficult to contain that pollution, that toxic runoff. Acid mine drainage is a big problem with almost every mine that's hard rock mining, gold or copper. And miners, when you're a geologist or hydrologist and you come out of graduate school or college, your biggest job offers are from mining companies. These are people who went to college really for very good reasons. They're really in love with rocks, or they're really in love with water or what it does, and they really want to do good. And when they go to mining companies, they still want to do good. They really do come to mining installations with the right intention. There's just not an answer except for abatement and trying to almost steer, if you want to call it that, the pollution in the direction they want to. But they really can't actually stop from going eventually into the water. So where you mine becomes actually as important. You have to mine. There's ways to mine, of course, that were very sensible. Where you put your waste rock, where you put your tailings. In the United States, they're getting better and better at that. But the location of a mine becomes very pivotal. If you're going to put it really near a known water source, i.e. river or streams or aquifer that feeds a lot of people, that should be heavily considered as maybe a no.
Let's talk about these companies. Some of these mining companies are some of the largest corporations in the world. They operate internationally. You talked about U.S. law getting more restrictive on pollution, but there are mines all over the world owned by these same companies or proposed by the same companies. And the companies, in many cases, were started by some interesting capitalists over the last several hundred years. You've met a few of the current ones. We'll get to that in a minute, too. Let's talk about three or four of the largest corporations that do copper mining. And by the way, copper is, you've already alluded to this, copper is often associated with other metals such as gold and lead, which are also very profitable. Who's been involved in starting some of these huge corporations?
This was one of the most fascinating aspects of discovery, is who are these copper mines? Because copper mining, like all mining, and oil and things like that, is a very hidden industry. You really don't know much about them.
Unless you live right next to a pit.
And even then, you don't know them. You don't meet the CEOs. You don't meet the boards. You don't meet the, you know, it's a, they're very, they're hidden for a reason. They do things that around the world in our own country that people don't like. So they have a wall of secrecy. But if you kind of dig a little bit, you start to realize the people that began these companies are the same people that basically ran this country from its industrial age or before that. There was a company called Asarco. Asarco was a very large company in the world for copper. It was basically the people who owned almost 75% of the world's smelters. And the family that owned Asarco was the Guggenheims. And people don't know that. Kennecott Mine, which is the largest physical mine in the world, is in, outside of Salt Lake City. That was the Guggenheims. McCarthy in Alaska, that was originally called Kennecott, was a mine owned by the Guggenheims and J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan was their banker, so J.P. Morgan was very involved in almost all of their mines. They own mines in Arizona, Mexico, South America. They own smelters all over the world. And they pretty much ran that until not that long ago, and now they don't have any piece of it. But it is what the Guggenheim fortune is founded on, is copper mining. You have, again, J.P. Morgan. You have William Clark, who is a really big player.
Clark was big in Montana.
Right.
And became a U.S. senator, the richest and most powerful economic force in the state, got elected. That's not the first or last time. And apologized to no one for anything, basically.
That's right. He was, a real bully in many ways, and a real force. You know, he founded Las Vegas. He owned Jerome in Arizona. He owned gold mines everywhere. He built railroad tracks all over the West. They call him the second richest man in the world at that time behind, I guess it would have been Rockefeller, or maybe J.P. Morgan. Anyways, it's an amazing empire that was built. And not only here, a lot of the families, the Vanderbilts, other families, they also did their copper in Africa. It's a little bit of like Conrad's Heart of Darkness. It was all in the Congo, which is still one of the biggest copper belts in the world, the Congo and northern Zaire. And those families really, really savaged the Congo for copper and made a fortune and built their empires, built their homes here.
Yeah, you mentioned in the book there's a current mine, either the biggest or one of the two biggest in the world, in Indonesia.
Yeah.
The company is Freeport-McMoRan, which is an interesting company, and folks can read about it in the book, with an interesting CEO. One of the directors of that corporation is Henry Kissinger.
That's right.
Who our listeners also will associate with another thing that happened in Indonesia in East Timor way back in 1976. This is not the program to get into a whole lot of history. But politicians have been tied with this industry quite a bit. Back in Arizona, Governor Bruce Babbitt in 1983 brought in the troops to break a strike and later became U.S. Secretary of Interior.
And the irony of that, of course, is Bruce Babbitt is a champion known as a champion of the wilderness.
He says.
Yeah, and also he's a champion of, labor. But at the same time, he broke the breaking of the union in Morenci. Morenci is the largest copper mine in the United States. Has been for a very long time. It's in very kind of a hidden in the eastern part of Arizona. When he brought in the National Guard and broke the unions, and five people died, he essentially the copper union was very powerful in Arizona. It was over. There are no more unions in Arizona. That was the end of it. So Bruce Babbitt has a really weird role, considering his background and his future.
Maybe a little more likely, less surprising, is that Senator John McCain of Arizona has really supported mining, particularly one proposed land exchange where a mining company would be able to use federal land in return for some forested land that they own, something like that. And McCain has been supporting that land swap. And a congressman from Arizona, Rick Renzi, supported it. In an illegal way and went to jail, I guess.
That's right. He just got a 3-year sentence for, I guess, it would be racketeering or maybe something along those lines. He was trying to, profit on the side by the land swap, and he got busted for that. It's been a long journey to try to get that land swap, and it's a very fascinating story, but there's a lot of politicians involved trying to get that to happen.
Yeah, and not just the U.S. government. Now, the Chinese have invested heavily in Africa, various countries for various reasons, but in the Congo. And I don't want to get away from the word savaged that you used, but for them, their economy is growing so fast, they sincerely need copper for electrical wire and all the other things. Their situation now, this is my opinion, not yours, is not unlike the way U.S. government and U.S. companies have gone into the third world over many years. You can comment on that or not.
Yeah, no, I pointed out in my book that they didn't invent what they're doing. We did. We were the original capitalistic, you know, opportunists. We did that all over the world. We didn't really build empires like England did, where we kind of lay down railroad tracks and do all this stuff. We just made money and just left. And China's doing that all over Africa for lots of natural resources, not just copper, you know, oil, timber, food. So they have colonized in many ways Africa at the moment. And they've also exported their smelters, which is, if you're, you know, China today is literally choking to death in the big cities. And a lot of that's coming from smelters. So they're moving their smelters to Africa to, I think in 20 years, you're going to have a very polluted African continent around the smelters. Another thing we should talk about, just because the irony, is Henry Kissinger. You brought him up. Henry Kissinger is an active board member of Freeport-McMoRan, which is the largest copper company in the world, the ones that own all the mines in Arizona. His role also should be noted in Chile. Chile is the largest copper producing country in the world, by far. They're the biggest player in this game. When Chile, under Allende, tried to nationalize the copper mines, that is what got us involved in, eventually, remember, do you remember the story? He eventually died, committed suicide because he was about to be attacked by people that we supported, directly Henry Kissinger supported, to overtake him, his presidency. His role in that has been heavily debated as a war crime or not a war crime by many people, but that was directly related to their taking of the copper mines.
You're listening to Bill Carter, author of Boom, Bust, Boom on KBOO Radio. Let's get a little closer to home, a few hundred miles, but within the U.S. A proposal has been made to open a huge mine in Alaska called the Pebble Mine. Tell us what was proposed, what the countryside looks like, and where the proposal has gone.
It's been proposed since 2005, about. The landscape is one of the most remote places you can really kind of conjure up in your mind. This is the wilderness that you dream of when you read Jack London or Farley Mowat, you know. Forests, lakes, mountains, bears, caribou, wolves, and only native people live there, native Alaskans.
And salmon, and I know you know something about salmon.
Yeah, salmon. That's the most important thing, is that Bristol Bay, Alaska, is the largest salmon run in the world. Half the world's salmon come from Bristol Bay. Half of those salmon are born in one lake, Lake Iliamna, which is the largest lake in Alaska. It's huge. It's up the Kwajalein River. That lake is really the largest hatchery, natural hatchery of salmon, red, especially sockeye salmon. This mine would have been 14 miles from that lake. Now, that area is almost exclusively tundra, meaning it's very wet to your foot. When you're walking on it, it's like walking on kind of a sponge. It gives way to your foot. One of the biggest issues of when you hard rock mine is that when you create these heavy metals from the rock that you're bringing up, is containment. If you are doing it in a desert, it takes a long time to get to the water sources. If you're doing it on tundra, it's going to get to the lake 14 miles away rather rapidly. I would say very rapidly, because there's really nothing. You don't have to go down 1,000 feet or 2,000 feet to hit a fissure. You're going to go right off the surface. This mine would have been enormous. It's worth about $500 billion in gold and copper and molybdenum. And they would have totally destroyed two major players in the salmon breeding creeks. They would have built 66 miles of roads over 55 streams, which would have run massive amounts of sulfuric acid back and forth, back and forth. So the concept here, people who opposed it, is we appreciate that you're telling us this will be a modern mine, but there's no way, whatever you do, however well you do things, you can't stop what is a natural occurring process of erosion into this lake. It's not like you're not trying. It won't happen. You will not succeed. I did a tour up there with the CEO of the Pebble Partnership, John Shively, who's a very well-known character in Alaska. And also, by the way, he's a very intelligent, very interesting man to speak with. He gave me a helicopter tour of the mine site. And he never fished in his life. He has a lot of friends that have. But I said, John, I'm a fisherman, and I'm a reporter, and I live in Bisbee. And I'm telling you right now, this is not going to work. There's no way this can work. Do you understand that? And he said it could. You know, we can have these two things work together.
Well, one thread that runs all through your book is the frustration that you experienced talking to some folks, John Shively in particular, who, again, was heading this proposed pebble mine. Can I ask you to read a selection from your book about your meeting with him?
Sure. I'm not so sure the spill actually hurt the salmon run at all. He's speaking about the Valdez, Exxon Valdez spill, which I had told him, you know, hey, there's a good example of something going wrong. And he says, I'm not so sure the spill actually hurt the salmon run at all, Shively says, smiling, as if he knows a few scientific facts that I don't regarding the destruction of the Prince William Sound coastline. Or if there was damage, there doesn't seem to be any real sustained damage today. I am shocked he has said this out loud, and to me. I know salmon, and I know fishermen who lived in the region that was destroyed by the spill. While it's true that 20 years later the pink salmon run has begun to recover, most of the recovery is due to the hatchery fish released into the Prince William Sound. The herring, which was the backbone of the local fishermen's livelihood, has yet to show any real sign of recovery. Countless other species have never recovered. To even hint that the spill's long-term effects are negligible is borderline psychotic and definitely delusional. To utter these words as a company man fighting to open a mine in a volatile region near salmon spawning grounds makes my head spin. I figure he was just reaching, grasping at straws. Part of me imagine he doesn't believe half of what he says. And when the time comes to break ground on the mine, he will quit. Maybe he will cite personal family reasons and bow out. Maybe he will circulate rumors that he was always against the mine, but took the job to make sure it was held to the highest standards. Sort of a Trojan horse that always has the best interest of the region in mind. Publicly, he will thank Pebble for the opportunity and hope the region profits greatly from the project. I have to tell myself this as I sip my beer, because otherwise I have no choice but to break this beer glass on his face. On the long flight home, I realize that writing about saving wilderness is difficult.
Thanks for reading that. You knew from personal experience that that mine would probably destroy the existing economy there, the salmon and herring. Some people, uninformed or because they're concerned about jobs, politicians and others, would say, look at all the people who are going to be hired here. And mines do pay well, even though the unions don't have power anymore. Some people go for those arguments, mm-hmm. like the ones he's making, and it drove you crazy.
Well, it should drive anybody crazy. Let's be really, really clear. They were promising about 1,000 jobs, and like you mentioned, well-paying for sure. Well, more better paying than anything anybody is making in that area. And this is a very remote area of Native Alaskans that have very little money. Let's give them that credit. But here's the thing. The salmon fishery produces around 14,000 jobs and $1.5 billion a year. Not to even mention the other jobs that extend from that, which are, you know, the salmon flying down here and going to restaurants and, you know, blah, blah, blah. So why would you rationally change or threaten this massive fishery, which exists because it's wild, pure salmon, for 1,000 jobs when you have something that is sustaining there? You don't have to do anything besides work hard to get salmon. You don't have to, like, you know, put water on the water. You don't have to feed it. You don't have to do anything except for show up in June, work really hard, and pull the salmon out of the water. And if you keep doing that, they're going to keep coming here until you screw it up. So in the most basic way, our biggest job in Pebble is not to do anything, not to screw it up. We're really good at that. We're really good at, like, going into a place and destroying it. And that all sounds very rational for me talking like that, but it's very hard to talk to a corporate powers that are going to make a lot of money. And they have a lot of money and a lot of ways to influence your mind to convince you that those 1,000 jobs are worth potentially destroying the world's greatest fishery. Now, the good news is the mine is basically dead. The EPA has invoked the Clean Water Act, And if they are successful doing it, which I think they will be, that will essentially kill the mine. That's another story, but it's unheard of. It's never been done. They preempted the permitting process. That has never been done in the history of the EPA. They did it because they realized how important it was to save the fishery before this got too far down the road. It's an enormous victory, and it's not something to rub in miners' faces, but it is something to hold up and realize there are... It gave me great hope that they did this, because when you are putting money and extraction versus food and water, which I think is where this book, where this argument is going over the next 50 to 100 years, where this world is going, is are we going to poison ourselves while we're getting new phones? You know, are we going to poison ourselves while we get new cars? It reinvigorated my belief that we do the right thing sometimes.
Okay, well, one more example, much closer to home. Someone has proposed a copper mine right near Mount St. Helens. Tell us about that.
The problem is this footprint, as they call it, a mining area, a mining district, is really near a river. It's actually, the river runs through it. I think it's called the Green River. You also have an old growth area, and the footprint's pretty small. So if they're going to explore there, and they're going to, if they ever want to do an open pit mine, and if they ever tell you that they're not going to put it in that river, not even on purpose, just understand that that's insane. There's a task force that they are fighting very hard to oppose the mine even from even getting anywhere near started. They're opposing them.
Well, this is federal land. Has a formal proposal been made to the government yet?
No, they haven't started the permit process. They're exploring. Okay. They're doing exploratory holes. I remember it's the Gifford-Pinchot
National Forest.
And that's the Gifford-Pinchot Task Force is the people that are fighting against it.
Okay. And the site is actually just outside Mount St. Helens National Monument in the forest. So the Forest Service would be involved if and when there is a proposal, probably EPA, possibly the state, local government for zoning.
But you have to, people don't realize this. There's a, the Forest Service, they cannot legally say no to a mine. Their job is to use the forest for some sort of profit, whether it's recreational or cattle or, you know, lumber or mining. Their job when it comes to a mine is to tell the miners what they have to do to raise the bar on their quality to not, you know, maybe pollute so bad. But they can't say no. They're not allowed to say no because of the 1872 Mining Law Act. One of the things that I wrote the book for is, and what I've talked a lot about around this country, is we need to change the 1872 Mining Law Act because it's ridiculous. This is a foreign company that will pay $5 an acre to mine and zero royalties on whatever they get out of that
place.
Zero
royalties. Bill Carter is the author of Boom, Bust, Boom, published in hardcover in 2012 by Scribner, and just out in paperback in 2014, published by Schaffner. Bill, how can people find out more information about these issues?
Well, the best place is to go to my website for the book. It's boombustboombook.com. So that's pretty simple. That's the main website for the book. And I have various links on there and blogs and all kinds of things about current issues, whether it's Mount St. Helens or Pebble Mine or something overseas. So that would be a really good one to go to. You can also, there's also, just look up copper mining. You'll find a million different things on, you know, what's going on.
Bill Carter, thanks very much for coming into KBOO.
Thanks very much for having me. It's always lovely.
And that was host Bruce Silverman conducting the interview with Bill Carter. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Joseph Gallivan interviews Scott Fife, scenic designer for Portland Center Stage's current production of Othello, and Fred Shaning, the technical director at Portland Center Stage. They talk about the challenges and process of designing and building theater sets. That's just in a minute.
KBOO at the Clinton every second Thursday at 7 p.m. This month, KBOO is proud to show the documentary Queen of the Sun, What Are the Bees Telling Us? The film is an alternative look at the global bee crisis. Before the film will be a short discussion with bee experts on how to help save the bees. That's Thursday, May 8th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Mobilizing Local Culture, a University of Oregon Arts Management Workshop in Portland, June 23rd through the 28th, showcasing the ways in which local culture mobilized to make a difference in neighborhoods across the city. More info at aad.uoregon.edu/summer-intensive.
Like to take a cement fix, be a standing cinema, dress my friends up just for show, see them as they really are. But the people in my brain, too new pens to have a go. I'd like to be a gallery, put you all inside my show. Andy Warhol looks a scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
I'm Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Radio, Portland. My guests this week are Scott Fife and Fred Shaning. Scott is the scenic designer for Portland Center Stage's current production of Othello, and Fred Shaning is the technical director at Portland Center Stage. Welcome to KBOO.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So this